hear Russell Graves's case. I know we cut it a little fine. There were many aspects to the case. He saw the look on Ford Croft's face. Should he say that he had kept Kitteridge informed? That was a cheap shot. Ford Croft might see it as an attempt to shift the blame. I wanted to make sure the book wouldn't be published. It would do a great deal of damage not only to my father, and thus Special Branch in general, but also to a great many other people, sir. Ford Croft sat stone-faced. He didn't like being outmaneuvered, especially by one of his most junior men. And you didn't think to tell me about all this? Daniel raised his chin a little higher. Yes, sir, I did. But I went to Mr. Kitteridge for legal advice, because if it went wrong, I thought it better and fairer that you should be able to deny any knowledge of it. He met Ford Croft's eyes with some trepidation. You told me you promised Mr. Graves your best effort to acquit him, sir. He will be acquitted, beyond any doubt at all, of murdering his wife. You will have kept your word. And publishing the book? Ford Croft's eyebrows went up. I don't know if you promised my father or Special Branch any sort of consideration, but if you did, you will have kept your word in that too. You're impudent, sir, Ford Croft said a little stiffly. I'm sorry, sir. I'm very new at these complicated problems. Daniel kept his appearance, innocent, with some difficulty. He couldn't afford to have Ford Croft think him sarcastic. Ford Croft's face very slowly relaxed and a smile curved his lips. Nonsense, he said. You're a born conniver. One day you'll make an excellent lawyer, although I imagine you will always like the wrong cases. Don't lead Kitteridge astray, even if he wants to go. Do you understand me? Yes, sir. Relief eased through Daniel's aching nerves. I think Mr. Kitteridge will always go with the law. And you won't? Ford Croft raised his hand. No, don't tell me. I will affect ignorance as long as I can. So, the publisher will decide against publishing Graves's beastly book? Are you sure? I hope so, sir. We managed to get several people whose families were implicated in the manuscript to explain their extreme displeasure at the idea and make it plain that these feelings might result in some very costly outcomes for the publishers, should they so slander their relatives. A certain peer of the realm still carries fond memories of Lady Vespasia, for instance. And how did you find that out, young man? A lot of detailed study, sir. Daniel kept his face perfectly straight. And a lot of help from that scoundrel Blackwell, no doubt, Ford Croft said wryly. A little, Daniel admitted. Marcus grunted. Be careful who you trust, Daniel. You're very young, and a good deal too idealistic. Yes, sir. Marcus slapped his hand on the desk. Don't yes, sir, me, damn it. I know there's no use warning you. I tried warning your father, and he went his own way. But while you work for Ford Croft and Gibson, you'll do as I tell you. If you don't, you'd better be careful I don't catch you. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, what? You'll be careful. Daniel smiled sweetly. Yes, sir. He stood a little straighter. But we have a lot more to do, sir. Ebony Graves is to be charged later this morning. I promised to represent her, sir, and I trust the charges will be withdrawn against Graves. With your permission, sir, Mr. Kitteridge will be in court also to be certain there's no error. I will be in court myself, Ford Croft answered him. This is a spectacle worth seeing. I dare say Miriam will too. She'll not forgive me if I leave her out of it. We'll be there at 11 o'clock. Now, get all your information in order, and don't disgrace us by making an ass of yourself when you're this close to winning. No, sir. Thank you. Daniel turned to leave with a sigh of relief, followed by a new burst of energy as he thought just how much there still was to prepare. Daniel left Ford Croft's office and almost bumped into Blackwell, and his chest tightened until he could hardly breathe. Blackwell's face broke into a slow smile. Tell me, Daniel demanded. I went to see a certain publisher, Blackwell said, and managed to persuade him that publishing a particular biography would be against his interests. Very much against them indeed. It would make him a remarkable number of enemies in very powerful places. I'm happy to say I scared him out of his wits. His face was transformed by a dazzling smile. Serves the bastard right. Daniel was almost too choked to speak. He took Roman's hand and shook it. Thank you. Thank you, Blackwell. The hearing for the appeal of Russell Graves against the sentence of death in the murder of his wife, Ebony Graves, began at 11 o'clock exactly. Kitteridge appeared for Russell Graves, who sat in the court looking ashen. He appeared at least 10 years older than the last time Daniel had seen him. Kitteridge looked nervous as he began to speak, although he could hardly fail. My lord, Russell Graves has been found guilty of murdering his wife, Ebony Graves. To prove that it is incorrect in law, I would like to call one witness, if it pleases your lordships. There was a moment of total silence. Then one of the three judges of appeal nodded very gravely.
You had better be certain of your facts beyond a doubt, Mr. Kitteridge. Who is your witness, and how are they relevant to this case?
My witness is Mrs. Ebony Graves, my lord, Kitteridge said, perfectly steadily. There was a moment of blank disbelief, then gasps. Someone cried out in denial. Then came shouts and the sound of movement as several journalists shot to their feet and stumbled out, making for the street. Daniel turned to look up at the dock. Graves was paralyzed with shock. He was leaning forward as if he couldn't believe what Kitteridge was saying. At last the presiding judge leaned forward.
I will not tolerate levity in this extremely serious matter, Mr. Kitteridge. Be warned. Should you fail, your client is due to be hanged very soon.
My lord, my witness is Mrs. Ebony Graves, or was so to the best of my knowledge and belief until earlier this year, Kitteridge replied. The judge's temper was clearly frayed.
I don't know what you mean. You had better proceed, but if you're acting in anything but the best possible faith, not only will your client pay for it with his life, you will pay for it with your career.
Yes, my lord. I call Ebony Graves to the stand. There was utter silence as Ebony appeared. She was dressed in dark grey, even though it was a bright May morning. She looked sober, but she walked with her head high, and her black hair gleamed in the courtroom lights. Her expression was composed, and at a glance you would have thought she was without nerves. But Daniel could see the stiffness of her shoulders, and her hand nearest to him was clenched, knuckles white. She took the witness stand and was asked to swear to her name. "You are Ebony Graves?" Kitteridge asked.
"No," she said very quietly. "I thought I was. But I discovered at the beginning of March this year that I am not. Our marriage was bigamous, all 20 years of it. And therefore, both my children are illegitimate. I'm still Ebony Cumberford, as I was born."
She was having difficulty controlling her emotions, and it showed in her face, and a very slight unsteadiness in her voice. "But until then, you thought you were Ebony Graves?" Kitteridge asked.
"Yes."
"There was no one else by that name to your knowledge?"
"No."
"How did you discover this situation that you are in? Do I call you Miss Cumberford?"
"I suppose you do.
I have no other name now." "How did you discover your situation?" Kitteridge repeated. "A woman came to visit me at my home. She introduced herself as Winifred Graves only when she was inside, upstairs."
"Upstairs?" Kitteridge interrupted.
"Yes, sir. I have a private sitting room upstairs for family guests. It's less formal."
"I see. Please go on." "At first I assumed she must be my sister-in-law. My husband hadn't spoken much about his family, but I knew that he had a sister." She drew a deep, shaky breath. "Only when we'd been speaking some little while and I had mentioned to her my two children, Sarah and Arthur, did she laugh and say it was a pity for them.
What was she referring to?"
"It was then she told me Graves was her married name. She was not my sister-in-law. She was my husband's first and only wife. He had married her nearly 30 years before, and the marriage had never been dissolved. She was still Mrs. Russell Graves. And now that he had inherited a title and considerable lands and money, she decided to take her share of it, which, as far as I was concerned, was all of it. I and my children would be out on the street."
"I'm sorry," Kitteridge said with deep feeling. He waited a moment before continuing. Daniel knew Kitteridge was tense. Not only did he want to win this case, as he wanted to win all cases,
but his sympathies were very much with Ebony. Graves had been his client, and he had seen enough of him to dislike him heartily. Ebony was, technically speaking, not his client. He sought her information in order to clear Graves.
"That must have been a dreadful shock to you," Kitteridge resumed. "What did you do?"
"I argued with her," Ebony replied. "I don't remember exactly what I said. I told her I had 2 children, and the result would be to make them illegitimate. I have not the means to care for them without my, as I thought, husband. I appealed to her mercy." She stopped. The memory was clearly humiliating. Kitteridge didn't help her. Daniel felt his body knotting tightly. He knew why Kitteridge was silent, but he also knew that had he intervened, it would have been wrong. Did the judge see her distress and know that she had tried and failed?
"She laughed at me," Ebony said, lifting her head and staring straight back at Kitteridge. "She said she had had her years of being beaten and humiliated by him, and she was owed what she could get out of it now. Either she would tell everyone she was his legal wife and could prove it, I never doubted her, or he could pay her off every month for her silence and I could stay, and be abused by him, and pretend I didn't know the truth. I was a kept woman, a mistress, and not a wife. And my children had no claims on him for inheritance, or help of any sort.
She stopped. "Is that important to you? Inheritance, Miss Cumberford?"
"Yes, it is.
My son Arthur is an invalid. He's confined to a wheelchair. His life depends upon regular medical attention. There is a treatment that might ultimately restore him to something like normality, but it's expensive. Without my husband providing for us, we would have no way of survival, let alone medical care. My daughter Sarah would have no prospect of a good marriage if she was known to be illegitimate."
"Not in your own society, perhaps," Kitteridge agreed. "But she might find a man who loved her for herself." His voice trailed off. That was irrelevant at this point, and he realized it.
"Did you kill her, Miss Cumberford?"
Her face was white.
"Yes, I suppose I did. I didn't mean to. She was very unkind in her language. She called me a whore, an adventuress, and my children bastards. I called her a few things in return. I don't remember what, but it was equally unpleasant. She lashed out and struck me. I staggered backwards, and when I regained my balance, I slapped her back, open-handed, across her face. She lost her balance and fell sideways. She struck her head on the hearth and didn't move again. I realized she was bleeding from her head and not breathing. She was dead."
"Yes.
But not burned?"
Her voice was barely audible.
"No."
"Did you seek help? Call a maid or the butler?"
She stiffened.
"No."
That was a lie, and Daniel could see it in her face, in the rigidity of her body. Did the judges see it as clearly as he did? Had Kitteridge meant to do that? Or was he unbelievably clumsy? Or worse than that, was he going to betray her by implicating Sarah or Falthorne? He would have to. Anyone who defended her would have to. She couldn't have done it alone. But how far was he going to go? What more was necessary to prove that Graves was innocent? "Your husband did not help you in any way. I'm sorry, I mean Mr. Graves didn't help you." She looked surprised.
"No, of course not. If he had, he'd have known I was not dead, and would never have tolerated being accused of having killed me, let alone come within days of being hanged."
Kitteridge looked thoughtful. "But Winifred Graves was as much a threat to him as to you, surely?" She looked blank. "She couldn't make him illegitimate, or rob him of his means to live." Kitteridge tried to suppress a twisted smile, and didn't entirely succeed.
"No.
And I presume his parting from Winifred Graves was not against his will, to put it mildly. But his marriage to you was bigamous, although you didn't know it. Bigamy is a crime."
"I didn't know,"
she protested. "Not for you, Miss Cumberford, for the person committing it, Russell Graves. It might have remained a secret if Winifred had not presented herself at your home." She struggled with temptation. It was visible in her face. The judge leaned forward and was about to speak, when she finally answered. He did not know anything about it. It was I who damaged her face so she wouldn't be recognized. I dressed her in some of my clothes and set fire to her, and...
Kitteridge didn't allow her to finish. How did you do that, Miss Cumberford? It must have taken great nerve and strength.
I suppose so.
Kitteridge had to make the judge believe him. Daniel had seen his reluctance before the hearing began.
You dressed her in your clothes, and then put her back where she fell so it would still look like the accident it was. How did you make her clothes and flesh burn? Clothes I can see, but flesh.
Ebony looked so pale now that Daniel was afraid she might faint. He knew that Kitteridge noted it too, and he felt a sharp pity for him. Not something he had thought he would ever do.
I took some of my son's art supplies, Ebony continued in a hoarse voice. Linseed oil, and some oiled silk that I had. It's waterproof, you know. I knew they would burn. I put down some old cotton sheet, soaked in the oil, and the silk, and set fire to them.
I see. And you did all this alone?
Yes.
Think hard, Miss Cumberford.
Not only Russell Graves's life depends on this, but also your own. I want to believe you, but I find it hard. Winifred was a larger woman than you are, even if not by much, and a dead weight. You managed to strip her of her own clothes and dress her in yours, then lay her back in exactly the same position without any help at all. Please, tell me the truth. Are you sure Mr. Graves did not help you?
I'm certain.
Do you think he would be prepared to hang, rather than admit that I was still alive, and he had had a part in making Winifred look like me? He doesn't love me enough to die for me. He doesn't love me at all. I don't think he ever did, or he wouldn't have beaten me.
Then who helped you? She stood silent.
Was it Falthorne, your butler?
No. Do you think I would...
She stopped abruptly.
Trust him? Yes, I do. But I don't think you would allow him to be blamed for something he didn't do. I believe it was your daughter Sarah, who knew how Russell Graves had beaten you, because he beat her also. I think the two of you saw your chance to escape from him, and you took it. I don't think you thought further than that. I don't think you foresaw Russell Graves being hanged for murdering you, or what would happen to Arthur and Sarah after that, the guilt that might haunt them for the rest of their lives. I think you have come forward now precisely to prevent that, no matter the cost to you. But you would have borne it all, and chance she couldn't help you, as absurd as that seems. I cannot blame you, Miss Cumberford, but neither can I believe you.
She didn't answer him. He turned to the judge.
My lord, that is all the evidence I have to offer the court, that Russell Graves is not guilty of having murdered Ebony Cumberford, whom the court believed to be Ebony Graves.
Thank you, Mr. Kitteridge. It is not necessary for us to retire to consider our verdict. Quite clearly, Miss Cumberford, or Mrs. Graves, is alive and well. The verdict of guilty against Russell Graves is reversed. Appropriate action will be taken to that effect.
Thank you, my lord.
However, that is hardly the end of the matter. Charges must be made against Miss Cumberford. I think circumstances do not require that Miss Sarah Cumberford be charged as an accessory to the desecrating of Mrs. Winifred Graves's body. There's no proof that she did any more than assist her mother in the most tragic circumstances. No doubt she was shocked and frightened. She came forward before it was too late.
Thank you, my lord, Kitteridge said fervently.
However, Ebony Cumberford will be taken into custody and held for trial on the defacement of a corpse with the intention to portray an accident as a crime and allow her common law husband to be tried and sentenced for a crime that did not exist. This court is adjourned.
Daniel took a moment to absorb what he knew was inevitable. Ebony was arrested and charged. It was more lenient than he had feared it might be. Sarah was free, but she was so concerned for her mother that her own escape hardly registered with her. She looked at Daniel with terror in her eyes and guilt. You had no alternative, he said to her as they stood in the hallway outside the courtroom. If you'd left it any longer, the charge would have been murder.
But what will happen to her? What will happen to us, Arthur and me? We've nowhere to go. I can't look after him by myself. You will not be by yourself.
We're not staying with him.
Her fear was so intense she was almost paralyzed by it. Your father isn't going home, Daniel assured her. He's being arrested for bigamy. He won't dare touch you now, and you'll have plenty of time to work out what to do next. Anything can happen in 7 years.
Everyone will know we are not legitimate. We have no money, or...
First, we must think of defending your mother. For tonight, you can go home and be safe.
Will you defend her? We can't pay you.
Let me have one of Arthur's paintings. That will be payment enough. Not his favorite. Another one.
He'll be happy.
Suddenly a smile broke through.
They are beautiful, aren't they?
Before he could answer in agreement, they were joined by Marcus Ford Croft and Kitteridge.
Thank you, Mr. Kitteridge,
Sarah said with the utmost sincerity. I know you defended my father the best way possible.
Mr. Ford Croft, I'm very grateful.
I imagine my father will settle what he owes you.
Perhaps you will defend him for bigamy. That is not up to me, but... But can Mr. Pitt be permitted to defend my mother? I'm sure she would ask him to, if she was allowed.
I will not defend your father, Ford Croft replied. I've discharged my duty to him, and I think it very likely he would prefer his defense rest with someone else who can wholeheartedly represent him. But my firm would gladly represent your mother. Mr. Kitteridge is my best litigator, and he's at your mother's disposal. I'll send him to her as soon as possible. We must get the matter concluded as satisfactorily as we can. Daniel knew it was intrusive, and perhaps he was asking for something he had no right to, but the case wasn't over yet. Not only must Ebony be defended, but it must be done in such a way that the final blow went to Russell Graves' reputation. The trial must accomplish his ruin, so that when he was tried for bigamy, he would receive the maximum sentence, and he would no longer be believed when he spewed his lies, particularly about Sir Thomas Pitt. If Kitteridge failed to save Ebony, the legal charge against her was grave, and the evidence powerful. Graves himself might well be permitted to testify. He would be desperate for vengeance. This judge had been gentle with her. Daniel could not rely on another being so.
Sir, may I take this case?
Please. Daniel glanced at Kitteridge and knew he understood. He didn't wish to offend him. He found, to his surprise, that he actually cared about his feelings. But Kitteridge relied on law, which was against Ebony. This was a case where the jury must be made to care for Ebony and seek reasons to acquit her, or at least find a way to lessen the charge. Marcus looked startled. Mr. Kitteridge would assist me and make sure I honor the law, sir, Daniel pleaded. Kitteridge's eyes widened. The thought of being assistant to anyone was abrasive, to say the least, but to Daniel Pitt, who was a total beginner, clearly appalled him. Marcus looked from one to the other of them. Kitteridge, he said hesitantly. This once, Kitteridge granted, with obvious difficulty. It will never happen again.
Thank you, Daniel said, very soberly.
Marcus nodded and turned to walk away. I'll even second you, if it's possible, Kitteridge said, under his breath. Chapter 21. Sitting at his desk almost a week later, facing the reality of the trial, Daniel didn't feel nearly as certain of himself. He should have been less arrogant and let Kitteridge head the case. What had made him think he knew better? Trials were about law, not emotion, and certainly not justice. His professor at university had told him often enough, "You go to court for the law, not for justice." It was too late now. He would be facing a lawyer named Griswood, an agreeable-faced, fleshy man of roughly 40, who nobody seemed to know much about. He was not a Londoner, but came from somewhere in the Midlands, and was beginning to make a name for himself. Kitteridge interrupted his thoughts. "I've got all the witnesses you asked for."
"Oh, thank you."
Daniel didn't want to ask Kitteridge's advice, but he was overwhelmed. "Can you think of anyone I've missed?" Kitteridge raised his eyebrows.
"If I had, I'd have told you. Do you think I want to see you shot down? I think Graves is a total bastard, and I'd see him hanged with pleasure, if I thought it was even remotely legal, but it isn't. You can't hang a man for being a swine."
Daniel said nothing. He didn't really want to hang Graves if he imagined it. The reality of it. A gallows, a rope. The drop beneath. A person's life gone in minutes. Where there had been a human being alive, thinking, feeling, there was now just a corpse. It was horrifying. What if you had made a mistake at any point along the line? Even if you hadn't, that kind of judgment was too big to make. And yet he'd been willing enough to think of it. Perhaps he thought too much. It could make a person impotent to act. Sarah and Arthur were both relying on him to act, and he had given his word. Why? Because he couldn't bear to see them so afraid. He wanted them to feel safe. Now he must make good on his promise. "Pitt," Kitteridge said firmly.
"What?"
Daniel looked at him. "Don't underestimate Griswood," he warned. "He's known for letting his opponent think he's won, and then pulling something extra out of his back pocket."
"Thank you. I'll watch."
"I don't like playing second chair to anyone," Kitteridge went on. "Let alone somebody as green as you are, I admit. But if I can't make a good job of it, then I can't make a good job of first chair either. And believe it or not, I want to win this one nearly as much as you do."
"I do believe it."
Daniel smiled at him suddenly.
"You like Sarah."
It wasn't a question. He'd seen Kitteridge watching her and seen the faint blush on his cheeks when she spoke to him.
"I'm sorry for her," Kitteridge said,
then immediately went back to his own desk and buried himself with papers.
Daniel didn't comment, but he found himself liking Kitteridge more these days than he expected to.
The trial began 2 days later. All the formalities were gone through, and Griswood rose to open his case. He looked uncomfortable in his wig and gown, as if they'd been made for somebody of a more elegant shape. And yet he seemed confident enough. He strode out into the body of the court, bowed to the judge, and faced the jury. "Gentlemen, you're about to hear an extraordinary story about an ambitious woman. Beautiful, clever, but of poor background and ruthless self-control. I ask you not to look at her, not look at her tears or her smiles, not at the broken bones she claims to have suffered, nor those of her daughter, but at what I shall prove to you she did. My learned friend for the defence will tell you this whole story is a series of huge accidents, with no thought of malice, only fear. No thought of material gain, only preservation for her children. No intended violence or deceit, only circumstances beyond her control." He shook his head slowly.
"I will show you a story of cunning, deceit, and ruthlessness, ending in violence, which has never been far from the heart of it."
Daniel turned to Kitteridge. "What the hell is he talking about?"
Kitteridge looked puzzled.
"No idea."
"The defense will try to tell you it was a sudden and unforeseen accident, gentlemen. I will show you that it was heartless and cold-blooded murder."
It was Kitteridge who shot to his feet while Daniel was still sitting up in shock.
"My lord, the accused is charged with disfiguring a corpse, not murder. Perhaps our learned friend is in the wrong courtroom. I understand he's not from around here."
There was a murmur of laughter around the gallery.
Griswood smiled, all teeth and no charm. "The law is no different in London from the rest of England, my lord. When you plan the death of any human being, then bring it to pass, and run from the scene, that is murder, even in London."
He looked at Kitteridge.
"The charge has been amended. I did not apprise you of that. Perhaps you've not looked at your papers recently."
He looked at Daniel.
"Or your young friend has not, if he is indeed leading this case."
With a flash of memory that was like a cold hand on his flesh, Daniel remembered Impney coming in with an envelope, still sealed, and putting it on his desk. It was handwritten, and he had taken it for a personal letter, possibly as Griswood had intended. There was no point in arguing the issue now. It would cost time and give him nothing. He rose to his feet quickly.
"My lord, I did receive a handwritten note yesterday which I'm afraid I didn't open. I took it for personal correspondence.
It makes no difference. The plea is still not guilty, as I will prove in time."
"Very well, Mr. Pitt. Do you require extra time, or are you prepared to proceed?"
"I'm prepared to proceed, my lord." The truth hasn't changed, nor has the evidence that proves it. Then you may address the jury. But please be brief.
Thank you, my lord.
Daniel turned to face the jurors. He had their total attention, and he thought he saw, in one or two, some trace of sympathy as well. Gentlemen, this is a story of many emotions. As my learned friend has said, it starts with love on the one side and deceit on the other. It goes forward to tolerance and then abuse and then shame with a lifetime of betrayal and violence, but not by the perpetrators he suggests. It ends in terror, misjudgment, and then redemption. I shall prove it to you step by step. There was a murmur in the gallery and the whisper of silk as people moved positions. No one spoke. Griswood called his first witness, Falthorn. Daniel watched the butler, formally dressed in a dark suit and looking extremely ill at ease as he climbed the steps to the witness stand. He swore to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing else. He gave his name and his position in the home of Russell Graves.
"And did you hold that position on the night Mrs. Graves disappeared?"
Griswood asked.
"Yes, sir."
"In fact, you have held it for some 20 years, is that not so?"
"Yes, sir."
It was clear to Daniel that Falthorn disliked Griswood. It might not have been apparent to everyone, but Daniel had had several encounters with him, and all but the first time, when there was great stress upon them, he had observed his manner, and he both liked and respected the man. He knew by the inflection of his voice, the rigid arms at his sides, how deeply he despised Griswood.
"So it was quite natural that when Mrs. Graves found herself in a desperate situation, one with which she could not contend alone, she would ask your help, in the certainty that she would get it?"
Griswood asked.
"I hope so, sir."
Griswood treated Falthorn as an unwilling witness. Daniel wondered if he would say so openly. Did the jurors see the tension between them? They would judge it as either loyalty or obstruction, according to where their sympathies lay. Perhaps they would offer Daniel the chance to further expose the household dynamics. Griswood smiled.
"Did she, in fact, turn to you when she found herself with the dead body of her victim, and no satisfactory explanation, indeed no legal one?"
Daniel stood up. "Objection, my lord. It's not been established that there was no legal explanation. In fact, we intend to show that there's a perfectly legal explanation, and that the woman attacked Mrs. Graves, and in so doing, slipped and fell."
Griswood was immediate.
"It is not legal to burn a dead body until it's unrecognizable, my lord. Even in London. No one can imagine that it is, if they can imagine any such thing at all."
"That has not been established either, my lord," Daniel replied. My learned friend asked if Mrs. Graves called the butler when she had a dead body. That is all?
You are correct, Mr. Pitt.
Keep your questions in order, Mr. Griswood. You asked the witness if Mrs. Graves called the butler when she found herself with a dead body. Mr. Falthorn, you may answer.
"Yes, my lord," Falthorn said unhappily.
"She did. She was extremely distressed and told me."
"Yes, that will do, Mr. Falthorn,"
Griswood cut him off.
"Did you see the body of Mrs. Graves, the real Mrs. Graves?"
"I saw the body of a middle-aged woman. I had no idea at all at the time who she was,"
Falthorn replied punctiliously. He had years of training, of conducting himself as required, and keeping his own emotions in check. Griswood wouldn't easily catch him off balance.
"What you now know to have been the body of Mrs. Graves," Griswood said irritably.
But he knew better than to be seen to bully a servant on the witness stand.
"Was she burned in any way? What injuries did she have? Would you describe what you saw, please?"
"I saw the body of a woman of middle years, lying on the floor with her head by the edge of the hearthstone. There was a considerable amount of blood on the hearthstone and on the carpet beside her."
"Did you ascertain that she was dead?"
"Yes, sir."
"How?"
"She had no pulse, and she wasn't breathing. The wound on her head appeared to be quite deep, but I didn't touch it."
"Did Miss Cumberford make any request of you regarding the body?"
"Not at that time, sir."
"Then later?" "Don't make me pull teeth. Did she later ask you to assist her in disguising the body with her own clothes to make it seem as if it was she who had been murdered?"
"No, sir.
Murder was never mentioned. She told me what happened, that the woman was indeed Mrs. Graves, her husband's first, and as it turned out, only wife.
I didn't ask you to discuss the testimony that...
Griswood interrupted. I beg your pardon, sir? I thought that was exactly what you did ask. The judge almost hid his smile, but not enough that Daniel missed it. No doubt the jury didn't miss it either.
Mr. Griswood, the judge began,
you must either make your questions more specific, excluding what you wish Mr. Falthorne to omit, or put up with his fuller answers. I do not see the point of your objection. If he doesn't answer that on your examination, Mr. Pitt will hardly fail to ask him on cross-examination. Make yourself clearer, sir.
Griswood flushed with annoyance, but he was obliged to obey.
Yes, my lord. Mr. Falthorne, let me be plain. Was the body, as you saw it the last time, in any way burned?
No, sir.
So the burning, the disfiguring of her face and the upper body, happened to her after she was dead?
It must have, sir.
Did you have any part in it?
No, sir.
Did any of the servants?
This time, Falthorne was caught. Daniel knew it. He would be as loyal as he could to Ebony, but he wouldn't allow any of the other servants to take the blame for something he was sure they had not done. The conflict was clear in his face, probably to the whole court, and certainly to anyone who knew him.
Mr. Falthorne?
Griswood prompted.
No, sir. So, we may conclude it was not an accident or part of her death, and none of the other servants was responsible? Was there anyone else in the house apart from Miss Cumberford and her daughter Sarah and her son Arthur?
No, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Falthorne. That is all.
He turned to Daniel.
Your witness, Mr. Pitt?
Daniel rose to his feet. Griswood had left the door open just an inch for Daniel to push if he dared.
Did he?
Was it a trap? The sweat trickled down his body and his hands were clammy. Everyone was staring at him, waiting for him to begin. He had had no time to prepare for this change to the charge. The first judge had believed Ebony, but clearly the prosecutor for the case didn't. Daniel must take the chance. Mr. Falthorne, we must deduce from your testimony so far that only Mrs. Graves, as she believed herself to be, and possibly her daughter Sarah, were responsible for disfiguring the body of Winifred Graves. Falthorne looked at him as if he had betrayed his trust.
Yes, sir.
Not Arthur Graves, or whatever his name now is.
No, sir. He's confined to a wheelchair.
It seems an extraordinary thing to do without reason by Mrs. May I refer to her as Ebony? The situation is confusing. Can you think of any reason whatever why Ebony, with the help of Sarah, should change Winifred's clothes and dress her sufficiently that she could pass for Ebony? If she had left the body alone, it would have been clear enough that she'd slipped and fallen, injuring herself fatally. Why did Ebony not do that? Why on earth disappear? Falthorne hesitated. Before Griswood could object, Daniel spoke again. Mr. Falthorne, if you're afraid of someone, it's your duty to tell the court. A glimmer of understanding shone for a moment on Falthorne's face. My lord, Daniel appealed to the judge.
You must answer the question, Mr. Falthorne, if you can.
Falthorne straightened up.
Yes, my lord. I believe that. I can only think of her as Mrs. Graves. Was afraid of Mr. Graves, sir.
He treated her with considerable violence on many occasions.
Objection!
Griswood was on his feet, his face twisted with anger. Daniel interrupted. My lord, my learned friend opened the door by asking,
yes, yes, indeed he did. You may answer, Mr. Falthorne, if it is of your own knowledge and not hearsay.
Thank you, my lord, Falthorne replied. He looked back at Daniel, his expression completely altered.
I dislike speaking of it, sir, but most of the servants were aware that Mr. Graves, on many occasions over the years, beat Mrs. Graves, and even Miss Sarah. And at least to our knowledge, he even beat Mr. Arthur when he was young before he became an invalid confined to a wheelchair.
As butler, how did you become aware of this while carrying out your duty, Mr. Falthorne?
I was frequently upstairs, sir, because I attended Mr. Arthur. His mother was able to do everything for him when he was a child, but at a certain age it was no longer appropriate.
I was aware of what occurred because I was frequently close enough to hear. His emotion almost overcame him, and he suppressed it with difficulty. And certain injuries are impossible to hide. The lady's maid confided in me, in extreme distress, the first time Mr. Graves actually beat Mrs. Graves so hard, he broke bones in her shoulder and her arm. The first time? There were others? Daniel didn't even try to keep the emotion from his voice. Yes, sir. I'm not exactly sure. 5 or 6, I think. And Miss Sarah also. Only one that I'm sure of with a broken bone. So you understand Ebony's desire for him to consider her dead, and not pursue her? Yes, sir. You do not deny helping her, at least insofar as you didn't enlighten anyone in the police that she was alive, and therefore Mr. Graves couldn't be guilty of having murdered her. No, sir. I am prepared to be judged on that account. I knew you were defending her, sir, and I believe that you will be successful in saving Mr. Graves from the gallows. Thank you, Daniel said slowly. You had greater trust in me than I had in myself. That is all the questions I have for you. Griswood rose to his feet, looked at the jury, saw their faces, and sat down again. Falthorn was excused. The police, who had been called to the scene at the time of Winifred's death, came to the stand and testified at some length to all the circumstances. Griswood made much of the state of the body and the fact that Sarah had identified it as that of her mother. There was nothing for Daniel to do but wait silently, and not make more of it than was already there. The evidence took until the final adjournment. All right so far? Kitteridge said to Daniel as they left the court and went outside into the summer day. The street was loud with the sound of traffic, both horse-drawn and automotive. They were getting accustomed to the smell of fumes, as their parents had with the smell of horse dung. Daniel said nothing. He was full of doubts. He had not foreseen them changing the charge, and he felt that he should have. After a few steps, he spoke. I should have known that Graves wasn't finished, he said bitterly. We all should have, Kitteridge admitted. But we have to work with how it is. Getting that information from Falthorn was good. Now, what are we going to do to build on it? Griswood will call the police surgeon first thing tomorrow morning. He'll give the jury all the most disgusting details about Winifred. For what it's worth, I don't think there's any point in fighting him. We've got Miriam. Do you honestly think they'll take notice of her? She's got no recognized qualifications. I know that. Daniel already felt himself getting defensive. And the police surgeon, Griswood, and probably the judge, would give her a far harder time than Kitteridge did. She'll bring only the physical evidence that she can show them. I know her word won't serve anything, even though she knows more than all of them put together. Kitteridge smiled lopsidedly. Don't let your temper show, Pitt. Righteous indignation has its place, and this isn't it. Listen to me. I know what I'm talking about. Daniel didn't argue. They'd been over this before. His indignation wouldn't help at all. But the jury's might. He wanted the jury to feel for Ebony and Sarah, and for Arthur too, if it helped. We've got to prepare for tomorrow, he said instead. Feel like an early supper at the Boar's Head before we begin in earnest. Good idea, Kitteridge agreed immediately. The following morning, Griswood called the police surgeon to testify, as expected. He was a sympathetic figure and gave the facts as he had observed them, precisely as Griswood asked. He described the disfiguring in detail, but without ascribing any emotion. When it was Daniel's turn to question him, he rose to his feet, determined to treat the man with the respect the jury would see. Good morning, Dr. French. You have given us a very detailed yet completely understandable picture of what must have happened to the body of Winifred Graves. May I ask you one or two further questions?
Of course, French replied.
He was at least 40 years older than Daniel, and his lean, silver-haired look was a distinguished one that the jury wouldn't forget. What do you wish to know? You believed it was the body of Ebony Graves because you were told it was. Is that correct?
Yes. I was informed that the daughter, Miss Sarah Graves, had identified it as her mother. The butler also confirmed that, and the lady's maid identified the clothes.
There was nothing of the body itself that confirmed the identity to you.
I was not acquainted with Mrs. Graves or Miss Cumberford, as I believe she is more correctly known.
Actually, the woman you examined was Mrs. Winifred Graves. Ebony Cumberford is alive and well. The moment he had said it, Daniel regretted it. He didn't want to antagonize the doctor. French stiffened.
I was told who she was and had no reason to question it. It was the body of a woman of perhaps 60 or so, and she died from a severe blow to the back of the head. The damage to her face, neck, and shoulders was inflicted after death. That is all I testify to.
No one doubts you, Dr. French.
Can you tell me what caused the burning? More than extreme heat, of course.
Several expressions crossed French's face, finally resting on a degree of interest.
No. I was asked to ascertain whether it took place before or after death, and whether it could be accidental.
It could not.
Does flesh burn easily?
It blisters easily.
It does not ignite. Anyone who has burned themselves is painfully aware of that. If you're asking me how the burning happened, I don't know. I was only required to say that it was not caused by falling into the fire or by coming in contact with burning logs or a domestic iron for clothes.
Or some other, more deliberate act.
If you say so, sir. I cannot see how that serves your client. It serves only to prove that she's telling the truth. Thank you. Oh, before you go, did you find any evidence on the body of broken bones? Or scars from having been beaten? If I had, young man, I would have reported it, as a matter of course. There were old scars, well healed, which could have been caused in any number of ways. They were all at least 20 years old, dating from the time of her marriage to Mr. Graves. Apparently, a flash of interest crossed French's face, then died.
Thank you, sir.
That's all I have to ask you.
French inclined his head in a slight bow and left the stand.
Griswood's final witness was Graves himself. The man who climbed the witness stand was outwardly very different from the one who had sat in the dock only a short while ago. At that time he'd been angry, frightened, and exhausted, alternating between hope and fear. Today, staying temporarily in London, he stood upright, dressed in an expensive and well-tailored suit and freshly pressed white shirt, his hair expertly cut. It altered the whole aspect of his face and his entire bearing. Griswood treated him with almost deferential respect.
After your recent ordeal, I'm sorry you have to experience this new distress. However, I have to ask you to relive the whole story of your marriage, your difficulties with Ebony Cumberford, and the facts that have brought you to this tragic place.
Daniel felt a chill of apprehension. He glanced at Kitteridge and saw him shift in his seat, as if he, too, feared something as yet unknown.
You were married to Winifred Graves when you first met Ebony Cumberford, were you not?
Yes. However, we were living apart, Graves answered.
Did you tell Miss Cumberford that you were married?
Of course.
You were attracted to each other?
Yes. At that time, she was a very attractive woman.
Daniel studied Graves's face. He didn't seem in the least nervous. No one looking at him would see any tremor of fear, only a weariness at having his private grief examined yet again in front of strangers. Perhaps the jurors would sympathize with him.
And did you go through some form of marriage?
Griswood continued.
We had a ceremony. It wasn't a marriage. I was already married, as Ebony well knew. She was prepared to accept me and the life I could offer her in those circumstances. I admit at first I wasn't willing to get involved in a deceit, but she insisted, even after I told her of the disadvantages. She said she would move to a place where Winifred was not known and would not find us. I agreed that was what she wanted. He bit his lips as if momentarily embarrassed. She was a beautiful woman then, and very skilled in the arts of persuasion.
Are you saying she seduced you, Mr. Graves?
Griswood asked with as much innocence as he could contrive.
I suppose I am, Graves agreed.
So you lived together for 20 years and no one suspected?
As far as I know, no one did.
What changed, Mr. Graves?
I inherited a title quite unexpectedly. It was not from a direct ancestor, but someone on my mother's side of the family. There were 2 deaths in a row and the title passed laterally to me.
with a considerable amount of both land and money. And D'Ebony was aware of this? Of course I would not have kept such a secret from her.
How did that change things?
Why on earth would she want to run away from such good fortune? Was there some threat that your marriage arrangements would be exposed?
None at all.
But somehow or another Winifred found out, and she arrived to claim her place as my wife. She had fallen on harder times, and saw I was a famous man about to have a title and even more wealth. I was worth much more to her, and she felt she had a right to her place.
To be exact, to Ebony's place,
Griswood countered with a smile.
Yes. Did you tell her she couldn't return now?
I didn't see her.
She approached Ebony. I don't know exactly what transpired, except that Winifred is dead and Ebony is alive.
I don't know if she ever intended to tell me, but the things went badly wrong, and she ran away to escape the results of her actions. I didn't know at the time, obviously. I was in danger, quite wrongly, of being hanged for having killed Ebony, who was clearly alive. I never actually saw Winifred, and I certainly didn't kill her. From the evidence of Falthorn, who used to be my butler, you know more than I did until now. Beside Daniel, Kitteridge let out his breath.
The bastard, he said bitterly.
Griswood gave a slight bow, very slight, but it was a gesture the jury wouldn't miss. It was as if Griswood were acknowledging Graves as a gentleman, an equal for whom he had been able to perform a service. Kitteridge nudged Daniel.
Do you want me to do this?
No.
Daniel took a breath.
No, thank you.
Then don't make me wish I had, Kitteridge said with a smile.
Nail the swine. Daniel rose to his feet.
I don't need to introduce myself to you, Mr. Graves. We know each other quite well. Mr. Kitteridge had the responsibility of mounting the appeal after you were convicted of murder, and we found the proof that you were, in fact, not guilty. I dare say you remember me.
There was a rustle of movement, and definitely of interest around the room. The jury stared at Daniel with renewed attention, even respect.
Indeed.
Graves knew enough to be polite, whatever his actual emotion.
As you say, you didn't know what happened in that bedroom, or that the body was that of your first wife. In fact, your only actual wife. I believe you. What I find more open to question is whether the arrangement you reached with Ebony Cumberford was come to with her agreement.
Even more than your own.
She says otherwise. In fact, she has a certificate of marriage, which she believed to be valid.
Daniel turned to the judge.
I submit it into evidence, my lord.
It was duly passed up, and the judge regarded it.
If it is not, then it is a remarkably good forgery,
the judge said unhappily.
Miss Cumberford, will swear that she believed it to be real, my lord,
Daniel told him. Then he turned back to Graves.
Have you seen this document before?
No,
Graves said vehemently.
I always told Ebony that I was married and not free to marry her. She was perfectly happy to live in sin, as they say. Until Winifred turned up and threatened to resume her place at my side and accept her share of the inheritance.
His face was perfectly calm, as if he could see nothing more than an unimportant pretense in the matter.
And what would have happened to Ebony in that case?
She would have been exposed as a kept woman, I imagine.
Graves smiled very slightly.
She had a certain laxity in morals, but I think that would have caused her considerable discomfort. The loss of position in society, at least.
And the loss of a roof over her head. Food on her table, Daniel added.
Yes, I imagine so.
And even more, the illegitimacy of the children.
Your children, Daniel went on.
Sarah would find herself a bastard, with little hope of making a fortunate marriage. But rather more than that, Arthur would be without a name, without the medical attention he needs if he is to survive. That would have been devastating to all of them, would it not? You made no provision for them, did you?
It was barely a question.
I would have,
Graves said angrily, temper sharpening his voice. But as of today you have not, Daniel pointed out.
You've had plenty of time. You've given them no comfort or assurance at all.
He glanced only momentarily at the jury, but he saw the anger and the pity in their faces, and something that looked like disgust.
As far as they are aware, he continued, you're determined to put their mother in prison and leave them illegitimate and abandoned. Perhaps that's not fully sunk into their consciousness. They're too hurt and sorry for their mother. But it will. Sarah, at least, is terrified that Arthur will die, and she will be unable to save him. Daniel looked at the jury and saw several of them in deep anger and distress at the situation. Griswood must have seen it too, because he rose to his feet.
My lord, I know Mr. Pitt is young and inexperienced, but this is all an appeal to emotions. It has nothing to do with the facts that Miss Cumberford coldly and deliberately murdered Mrs. Winifred Graves. That is what we are here to try.
Indeed, Mr. Pitt, the judge said gravely. Mr. Griswood is correct. You will please address the facts relevant to that. You have only succeeded so far in making Mr. Griswood's case for him. Miss Cumberford had excellent motive for wishing Mrs. Graves to disappear, as she almost succeeded in accomplishing that.
Yes, my lord. I apologize to the court. I only wanted to establish Miss Cumberford's character, and the honesty, or otherwise, of Mr. Graves, the chief witness against her.
Your point is taken, Mr. Pitt.
Have you any other questions for Mr. Graves?
Yes, my lord.
A few.
Then proceed. But see that they are relevant.
Yes, my lord. Mr. Graves, you have suggested that your butler, Mr. Falthorn, is telling lies when he says you beat both your wife and your daughter regularly, causing them serious injury. Is he, in fact, not being truthful? If we were to ask the lady's maid the same questions, would she have different answers? Apparently, Mrs. Winifred Graves had several scars dating from the time she was married to you.
She was a clumsy woman, Graves said darkly.
And was Ebony clumsy too? He allowed the sarcasm he felt to be heard in his voice.
Occasionally, Graves replied, but there was a flush in his face and a sharp, brittle edge to his voice.
Are you clumsy also? Daniel asked. Have you had broken bones?
Griswood rose again.
My lord, this is impertinent, intrusive, and ridiculous.
It is not entirely irrelevant, the judge replied. And I do not find it ridiculous. I would like to hear the answer.
No, I am not clumsy, Graves said irritably.
Never broken a bone?
Daniel raised his eyebrows.
Be careful to be exact, Mr. Graves. We have science these days that can tell if a person has any broken bones, even before they are dead. Bones heal, but they look different from bones that have not been broken.
No, I have never broken my bones, and no science will find that I have, Graves answered, tartly.
What has this to do with the fact that Ebony killed Winifred and tried to get me hanged for killing her?
Oh, quite a lot, Daniel said with a tiny smile.
But we'll come to that later.
Thank you, my lord. That is all I have for this witness.
Griswood stood up and had Graves restate his total innocence and add some details of his suffering as a result of having been wrongly accused of murdering Ebony. Daniel addressed the judge.
I'm quite aware of all that, my lord. In case Mr. Graves has forgotten, it was I who worked night and day to prove his innocence.
Indeed, Mr. Pitt knows it most of all,
Griswood said with a wide smile.
The prosecution rests, my lord.
Chapter 22. Daniel began his defense immediately after an early lunch and recess. He had spent the time with Kitteridge turning over and over in his mind the possibilities. Should he present as much evidence as possible? Or should he not risk boring the jury or giving Griswood too much testimony to challenge? Griswood would certainly do all he could to destroy Miriam. He would try everything to discredit her skills or make a mockery of her in the courtroom.
Are you sure I should expose her to that? He kept asking Kitteridge.
He'll try to make her look ridiculous. He'll use every prejudice possible.
For heaven's sake, Pitt. She's a grown woman. Do you appreciate your mother fussing over you to protect you from life?
No, of course not, but that's different.
Yes, it is. She's your mother. It's her job. You are not Miriam's parent.
In fact, she's almost old enough to be yours.
No, she isn't,
Daniel replied hotly.
She's about 2 or 3 years short. She's got Marcus treating her as if she's made of porcelain. She doesn't need you to.
But Daniel wasn't convinced.
Believe in yourself, Kitteridge said. If you don't, the jury will sense it and you'll lose them. Bite the bullet, Pitt. Get on with it.
And so Daniel began by calling Ebony Cumberford. I apologize if I should slip and call you Ebony Graves, he began. But the majority of the time I've known of you,
It was by that name. She smiled ruefully. I thought of myself by that name, she told him.